This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And do you think you can predict the winners in the 2024 elections? Well, with Interactive Brokers Forecast Trader, you can actually trade your view. Simply answer yes or no. For example, will Harris win the presidency? Will the Democrats win control of the Senate? Will Trump win the presidency? Well, if you agree, buy a yes contract. If you disagree, buy a no. It's that easy. Prices range from 2 to 99 cents. Correct predictions earn $1 at settlement, and incorrect ones settle at zero. With commission-free trading and open positions earning 4.3% APY, there's no better time to get started. The best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Visit ibkr.com/forecast and get started today. Member SIPC.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Growth numbers could be coming in hot. More new highs for the markets. And we're 2 weeks away from the presidential election. Our guest today is Dan Pila, tax expert, and is going to help us look at some of the candidates' tax promises. All this and much more on episode number 891 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's Andrew Horowitz here, and a big hello from our new and remodeled Horowitz Company Studios in sometimes sunny downtown Fort Lauderdale. Yep, right in the heart of Florida. And it's really nice, change that we made. We did some really cool painting and blacked out and some new noise dampeners and some new cabinetry and a new desk, an L-shaped desk, which gives me a lot more room than we had before, and hung a bunch of the cameras and the lights in a different fashion and new, what else did we do? We did a bunch of other new things. What else? Oh, new chair. So it's really kind of nice and comfy. It's going to take me a little while to get used to be honest with you, but nonetheless, it will be there. The setup is now more video friendly for when we are asked to be on other shows, and that happens quite often. So it's going to be fun to set up the background of the studio and to see exactly, how it looks to you. So with that, we have a few weeks to go, don't we? Just a few weeks. Just about 2 weeks now till the end is over of the race. And we hope that will be the time that we get conclusion, closure on the presidential race. And that is going to mean a lot of things to a lot of people, of course. And we know, obviously, it's potentially going to be contested no matter what happens. But the promises are pouring in from each of the candidates and from the parties and from not only that, in the congressional races. All this is coming in hot and heavy with regard to what they are promising if you actually vote for either of the candidates or any of the people running for office. Well, we know that's happening, and the good news is that into the end of the year, we have some good seasonality. Oftentimes, presidential election cycles, the fourth year into the end of the year, is a positive momentum bias, because what we get there is all these great promises that they're going to lower taxes, they're going to give us money, they're going to buy us houses, they're going to buy us cars, no more taxation of this, no more deduction of that, or whatever it may be. And it appears, even without that, that the U.S. economy is doing pretty well on the whole. In fact, when we see the Atlanta Fed GDP Now numbers and the model estimate that came out for the third quarter GDP, growth was recently revised up from 3.2% to 3.4%. And that's important because we had the good retail sales, the industrial production reports, all those things that came into play that there was a lot of concern about has actually played out in favor of the continuation, or I would call it no landing, of the U.S. economy. Now, with that in mind, you have to wonder into November, December, what's the Fed going to do? We continually worry and wonder about that because it seems that they are really off-footed at this point. We talked about this. The 50 basis point cut that they put into place, well, that was something of interest, but yet was it too much, considering all the things that we know now with regard to how, in fact, well the U.S. economy is doing? Is it really, was it necessary? And is it going to be necessary to actually cut rates that much more towards the end of the year, considering all the promises that go on within this presidential election cycle? And then finally, how well things are going in the area of employment and, of course, in the area of the actual economic numbers itself. A lot of refinancing going on. People are still buying houses. And we're seeing that, of course, inflation is marching on. So all of that is going to be questions that we're going to have on our minds through the end of the year. One of the things that has been on people's minds, and we might as well get to the elephant in the room, is what exactly is going to happen if we have this party, that person in the White House. And I got to tell you, I've fielded a few different calls this week with clients, and we've had these really nice discussions about this exact topic. The concern about, well, what if Trump gets in? Or what if, you know, Harris gets in? And what is that going to mean? Because Trump is promising this and Harris is promising that. One wants to raise taxes. One wants to reduce taxes. One wants to do things that are going to balloon the deficit and the debt, and the other is going to do things that maybe even hurt me from my particular standpoint and maybe even my investments. What I've told them all is this, that there's no reason to get concerned at this point. One of the things that we really need to look at more importantly is the makeup of the government post-election. How is the government going to play out in terms of the party that is in, whether it's Trump or Harris, sitting in the White House, and what is it going to look like as compared to Congress? Is Congress going to be Senate and the House going to have Democrat, Republican, mixed? If in fact we have a Republican in the White House, but a Democratic overall, both Senate and House, Democratic House and Senate majority, nothing's going to get done. And in fact, that's what we want. We want gridlock. Markets like when less is done and we don't have all these issues that are going on with regard to the concern about one party rule where they could just steamroll and get everything that they want done. So in fact, if we look at all of the Harris proposals, and I'm going to ask our guest today about this because I think that's more appropriate to go through the tax issues with him because he's a tax expert. But if one party rules, like if it is Harris, maybe we will see capital gains taxes rise, and maybe we will see the corporate taxes that are set to renew and roll back to a higher level not be renewed. There are things like that is more concerning, but I don't think we need to worry about just who's in the White House. We need to worry about both White House and in Congress. So if you see, for example, that Harris gets in, but yet there's a Republican Congress overall, you're going to find gridlock, and markets may stabilize on that. If we see maybe Harris and get in and a Democratic Congress majority, then potentially there's going to be concern over some of these capital gains tax issues. That's really, I think, the biggest issue that we have right now. So with that, I think it's probably appropriate that we take a pause on my commentary and bring in Dan to talk about exactly these questions I have related to this election and what it's going to look like. And really more so, how are these some of these promises going to play out? And our guest today is Dan Peely. He's an expert in IRS procedure and advocate of taxpayer rights. He's author of How to Win Your Tax Audit, which is an important book to read, especially if you're anywhere near that, and especially with what's going on these days with the IRS having all this money to do nothing but try to find you and audit you. His primary calling is that of a tax litigator. He's considered America's leader in taxpayer defense, taxpayer rights, and the IRS abuse prevention and cure. Regardless, one of the country's premier experts in IRS procedures, general tax, financial problems, resolution techniques. He's helped just thousands of people solve personal and business tax problems. And we've had him on many times before. I want to welcome back, and always towards the end of the year so we get those year-end tax tips. Dan, how are you?
I am well, Andrew. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. You know, this hurricane that was supposed to be all sorts of problematic for everywhere, especially here, seemingly kind of really focused in on an area that we fortunately don't live in or work in for us. But escape that one as well. But feeling bad for everybody over in in the other parts of Florida. So let's talk about...
By all reports, it got hit pretty hard from what I saw.
Sure. Yeah. So we're still finding out. You know, it takes weeks to find out everything that goes on, you know? Sure. All right, let's talk about... I have a lot of things to go over with you. I have things with regard to some of your end tax tips. I have things, your recent Pilot Talks taxes. Actually, let's start there. Let's start with your latest September-October newsletter, Pila Talks Taxes, which people can get their hands on, of course, if they want. We'll have a link to your stuff on the show notes for episode number 891 on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You focused in on three Trump tax cut ideas and questioning if they have any reasonable, if they're good or bad. I mean, that's what you focused in on. Yeah, so let's kind of go through some of those, and then we're going to hit some of the Harris, and we'll then discuss some of the fallout from all this.
Sure.
Because I'm kind of curious about some of this stuff. eliminating tax on tips. Let's just start there. And by the way, if this goes through, I am in the tipping business. I'm in the receiving. I'm receiving the tipping.
Which of course is, I mean, you just put your finger on the problem with the proposal. You know, I'm in favor of tax cuts everywhere they show up. I'm in favor of tax cuts, no matter how they look. All right. Tax cuts are always good for the economy. It's just as simple as that. But what happens is the distortions in the marketplace that are created when you target tax cuts to certain industries, or in this case, certain types of transactions. If they exempt tips from taxation, who gets to be exempt? Is it just people in the service industry? Is it just people, well, even more specifically, is it just people in the hospitality service industry? Mm-hmm. Or is it service workers economy-wide? If it's service workers economy-wide, then there isn't going to be a company in America, Andrew, that pays tips or that pays wages to anybody anymore.
No
wages. They're all going to be working for tips. So obviously, it's the second layer of questions that have to be asked and answered before we can decide whether this is a good policy. On its face, what it looks like, you know, what happens, this is just me talking now, right? This is just my opinion, is Democrats try to buy votes with other people's money and Republicans try to buy votes with the taxpayers' own money. But in both cases, they're trying to buy votes.
Yes, yes.
And that is what I think is going on here with this particular proposal.
I mean, it's clearly, if you think about the amount of people that work in the service industry, specifically in the restaurant and that type of the service industry, you know, there's a lot of different areas.
But hospitality.
Yeah, hospitality that really work on tips. You know, the ones that were taking cash for years that didn't pay taxes on it, that now with the advent of some of these new payment systems and the desire of most people to utilize credit cards for payments, for things, well, nothing's hidden anymore, right? So now all of a sudden the underground cash community is they're outed. And, you know, now there's no way to get around it, because when your tip comes through on the system, whatever's being used, and at the end of the night you get that money or it goes into your paycheck, it is a fully taxable amount.
No question.
So
no doubt about it. And the IRS has been screwing itself in the ground for 25 or 30 years to try to capture, just like what you said, to try to capture this underground cash tip economy. And they've done a pretty good job of it, but it's not so much what they did, it's what the marketplace did. And what the marketplace did is it went to cashless transactions.
Right.
We've got the credit cards, we got the debit cards, now we got the Venmo and all the rest of that stuff. And all of that is 100% traceable, as you correctly point out.
You know, it's interesting. The one thing that I understand is not as required to be reported is Zelle. That's a weird Zelle, you know, Zelle payments.
I will say that first of all, I'm not familiar with Zelle, but I will tell you this: any payment that you receive in exchange for personal services must be reported to the IRS.
Of course. No, there's no question.
Now, whether a third party has to report it or not, it's a different story.
Right.
But I will say this. The general rule is that any third party that pays an individual more than $600 or more during the course of a year in the course of business, Andrew, that company is responsible to report to the IRS with a 1099. Whether they do it or not, of course, is a different story.
And just because you don't get a 1099 for money doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have to pay. Worldwide income for United States citizens is a reportable income source for taxation, right?
Yeah, you're exactly right. The receipt of the 1099 or even a W-2 for that matter is irrelevant. The fact that you earn the income and receive the wealth, right, the payment for services or the payment for the sale of goods or the combination of goods and services, the fact that you receive that payment is what triggers the reporting requirement on your own 1040 form. Right. So, I have people say to me all the time, well, Dan, this was cash. I don't have to report that, right? Wrong. You have to report it, and it's taxable income.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. So eliminate tax on tips. Do you think that's?
I'll go one step farther here to give you the extreme example. If you walk down the street, Andrew, and you pick up $100 bill and you put that $100 bill in your pocket, that's taxable income. That $100 bill has to be reported on your tax return.
Oh, all right. Well, I didn't find it. It wasn't me. Hold on a second. Now there's always a debit credit, right? Not to get into the total ridiculousness of this all. In a way, then I should be able to take it off my taxes if I lost it.
Well, except you can only claim the deduction if the expense was incurred in connection with the operation of a business, or if the expense was incurred in the active involvement of investing for the purposes of gain. So the simple fact that you lost it, well, that's just too bad.
Yeah. So
if you lose enough, it could be a casualty loss or a theft loss. That's true. But that's got to exceed a certain percentage of your adjusted gross income before that is going to be deductible. So the mere loss of the $100 bill is not going to give, if assuming that's your only loss, is not going to give rise to a tax deduction. Now, for those folks that tragically suffered through these hurricanes here in the last 2 weeks that have catastrophic losses, those losses can be deductible on their tax returns.
Just to really force out the inequity of the lack of equality of both sides of the tax law. If I'm walking down the road with you, Dan, and I have a $100 bill in my hand, Dan, and somehow it blows out and I lose it, I don't get the loss, but you pick it up, you got the income. Just to be clear.
That's exactly right. You are precisely correct. Yep. Yeah.
So I'm just saying that the tax, that's a ridiculous microcosm of the tax law to show how it is just imbalanced.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the problems you have that are inherent with an income tax system. All right, the tax code taxes all income unless it's specifically exempt, and deductions are a matter of legislative grace. They can give them or not. All right, and so that's what we're dealing with here. The IRS's position, the federal government's position, Congress's position, is that every dollar of income that's earned by businesses or individuals must be reported on the tax return. And then you work your way through the deductions and exemptions if they apply.
Right, because it's a harder thing to do that, obviously. It leans itself towards the house.
Sure.
That's the bottom line. Second up on the possible Trump tax cut ideas. Now, by the way, let's state the obvious, Dan, that any of these ideas, if they get through the process of the election, and if, in fact, they then become reignited after the election and proposed as legislation, has to then go through Congress, which may or may not be the same party as the elected official for president of the United States come next year.
Yeah, you're exactly right. So any proposal that's put out by Trump, any proposal that's put out by Harris is just exactly that. It's a proposal. It's not something that can automatically become law. And as I said a moment ago, really what they're doing is trying to entice voters one way or the other, right? And so you're precisely correct. Once that individual is elected to office, whoever it happens to be, then those proposals have to work through both the House of Representatives and the Senate, come out the other end in some semblance of resemblance to how they went in, which is almost never the case, right? And then the president signs them into law, and only then do they become a part of the Internal Revenue Code. So it is a lengthy and very, very methodical and deliberate process of creating these bills, and it doesn't happen overnight.
Let's talk about the next one. And there's obviously on all of these is a pro and con and a little sense of ridiculousness. Eliminating tax on overtime pay. Now, as I mentioned before, eliminating tax on tips, I'm going to become a company that just accepts tips. Now, eliminating tax on overtime pay, I'm going to pay myself $1 an hour, by the way, for 40 hours and $10,000 an hour for anything over. Just to be clear. Just to be clear.
And see, and this proposal suffers from exactly the same problem that the other one does. It's the unintended consequences, the market distortions that are created when you have this kind of targeted tax benefit to a very, very narrow segment of economic activity. My reaction to that, Andrew, was that, okay, every employer in the country is going to go to a 10-hour work week.
Yeah.
Right? So we're going to pay you a 10-hour work week, and everything over 10 hours is considered overtime. The other side of that coin is, what if the federal government comes out and says, yeah, we're not going to tax overtime, but now we're going to mandate that the ordinary, the quote, usual work week is 60 hours. You have to put in 60 hours a week before anything is considered overtime. Of course, America's unions will never go for that. But the fact of the matter is, this is what happens when you've got poorly thought out tax and economic policy. It creates these unintended consequences, and it creates these distortions in the marketplace that just aren't good for anybody.
I mean, it seems like we're just, we're focusing on Trump first here, but it seems like, as you mentioned, this bribery, let's just talk about what it is. It's election bribery, right?
It is. No doubt.
Or voting bribery. And, you know, it's getting bizarre. Like some of this stuff is bizarre. I mean, again, we have to get it through. You have to get the person elected. You have to get the legislative action done. You have to get the proposal into Congress and then vote it on. And then even if it is a Republican, right? Both sides, right. Both presidents, they may look at this stuff.
It would have to be Republican House, Republican Senate, and Republican in the White House for these things to pass through.
Well, and it has to be reasonable to pass, even if it is the same.
There is some
reason in the Democrat, or the some of them have some semblance of reasonability.
I'm sure we could find a half a dozen of them.
Correct.
He looked real hard.
So, but does this make any sense? Does this have any kind of legs at all? Or
I don't think it makes any sense. No, I mean, for the reasons that I've expressed, what happens is every tax policy, every kind of a tax that's imposed on any transaction you can name causes distortions in the marketplace. All right. A distortion in the marketplace is something that causes somebody to do something they otherwise wouldn't do, or prevents somebody from doing something they would otherwise be disposed to do. That's a distortion.
Right.
We want a tax system, Andrew, that creates or introduces the fewest amount of distortions into the marketplace, so people can buy and sell based on business decisions, right? Based on personal decisions that they make, business decisions they make based on what's best for me and my family, what's best for my business. We don't want people making decisions based solely on tax consequences. And that's all these proposals would do is create a whole body of decisions that are made based on tax consequences, not based on economic realities. That's not a good thing.
All right. Third one you have up here. This one's interesting, actually. Eliminating tax on Social Security benefits.
Now, this makes sense.
Yeah, right. There's no way I can distort. I can't distort that because I don't collect Social Security, so I can't say that if I'm changing my age or something. I can't come up with some shenanigans to get here. Exactly. So tell us what this looks like.
Well, what it looks like, what the proposal is simply is to eliminate, is to go back to pre-1979 law, wherein no Social Security benefits were taxed whatsoever. And this makes perfect sense because when you've got, as you earn income over the course of your working life, whether it's W-2 income, wage income, or self-employment income, all right, you pay Social Security taxes on that income and you don't get a deduction for the tax that you pay. All right, this is not a contribution to a retirement plan. Here's where the confusion comes in. People think they're contributing to a retirement plan that they get back. No, that's not what it is. It's another income tax laid on top of the ordinary income tax. This is a secondary income tax. And so you're paying taxes on that income as it's earned, and you don't get a deduction for it. So now, X number of years later, when you retire and you start drawing those Social Security, quote unquote, benefits back, then you are taxed again. And that was that condition was created in 1979. Before that, the benefits were never taxed. And so what this proposal would do is just dial back the clock to the way the benefits should be treated in the first place, the way they were treated in the first place, which is non-taxable because you already paid tax on the income.
Yeah. And also, you know, there's something to be said about the even versus 10 years ago, the high cost of things and how the people, particularly in lower income strata, that are receiving Social Security are really suffering. And sure. Yes, you know, you make $1 million a year off of your passive income. Should you be getting free untaxed Social Security? Okay.
Well, that's a different discussion. That's a completely different discussion. And so what you're talking about doing, which I think is a good idea, by the way, is means testing Social Security benefits. What's going on here? Here's what's happening with the taxation of Social Security benefits. All right, the Social Security Trust, the Social Security Trustees Board has reported repeatedly that Social Security Trust Fund is in danger because the demographic changes that have occurred in the United States over the last 50 or 60 years. People are living longer, right? And as the government adds additional benefits to the Social Security package, the government is paying more out in Social Security benefits than they're collecting in taxes. Mm-hmm. All right. So the thing is out of whack. We all know that. All right. So now we got to look at ways of making the Social Security Trust Fund solvent again. All right. They don't want to cut the benefits, but by taxing the benefits, they effectively cut the benefits without saying they're cutting the benefits, right? That's the only reason they're taxing these benefits is so they can effectively reduce how much they pay out without telling people we're cutting your benefits, right? Because people think it's a benefit. They don't think it's a tax, right? So if we means test it, which is something I've advocated for a long time, if you've got somebody like that example you just gave, they're getting $1 million in passive income, or they continue to work for W-2 wages and they're making, you know, $500,000-$700,000 in W-2 wages. Should they also then get a $4,000 a month Social Security check that's tax-free? They probably shouldn't get a Social Security check at all. The problem with that idea, Andrew, is people will go ballistic if anybody in the government proposes to means test Social Security, yeah, because everybody thinks they contributed to a retirement fund, which they did not do.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings on this whole thing. I was of the feeling for many, many years that if I have enough money, X amount of dollars or X amount of income, you know what? It's okay. I don't need the money that I paid in over the years. Like, I don't get money back on my tax money. It's fine. The older I get, I'm like, oh, you know what? I want my freaking money. You know? I'm like,
I'll tell you, it's everybody's, between Social Security and Medicare, it's everybody's favorite subsidy.
Yeah.
And that's what Social Security is. It's a subsidy. Yeah. It's a welfare program that's funded by an additional payroll tax,
yeah,
that you pay as an employer on your employees.
Yep.
And that as the employer, the self-employed person, you pay on yourself as well. We cannot introduce any level of honesty to the Social Security debate until the financial aspects of the Social Security debate, until we come to grips with the fact that it's not a retirement plan that you have invested in.
Yep.
You don't have a retirement fund in Washington with your name on it that's got all kinds of money in it that piled up over the years.
Right.
There's no such thing.
Yep. Just to be clear, when I say that the older I get, I'm nowhere near taking that benefit. Just to be clear. Okay.
Something has to be done.
Yeah, I agree. We just got 2035 was supposed to run out now. Question: whether it's the elimination of tax on tips, eliminating tax on overtime, eliminating tax on Social Security, or what have you, any of the other things, reduction of the corporate income tax, down to I don't know what, or keeping it where it is. It's supposed to be like a $7.5 trillion deficit that's going to be grown under these programs. Who pays for this?
Well, the problem that we're dealing with is nobody's paying for it. All right. All it's doing is adding to the total federal debt, which is now north of $34 trillion. And it's growing. We have stopped the public officials. I shouldn't say we, because you and I still talk about this. But public officials have stopped elected officials in particular, have stopped talking about the question of who pays for it. None of the when we went into the COVID programs in March of 1990, you and I talked about this through March of 2020, when those COVID programs started and all those giveaways started. You and I talked about this mm-hmm. on the air back in those days. And the question came up, who's going to pay for it? You might recall that in all those programs, starting with the CARES Act and going all the way through those four or five acts of Congress that gave out almost $10 trillion, nobody once asked the question, how are we going to pay for it?
Right.
No one cares anymore how we're going to pay for it.
No one cares. Isn't that the truth?
Nobody cares.
Because we figure that if Japan could live on the edge like they have. And I ask this question to everybody that's come on. If the United States was a corporation traded on the market, would you buy it from a fundamental standpoint?
I wouldn't buy it. No. I wouldn't buy it, and I would never advise a client to buy it.
Yeah.
It would be an insane investment.
Yeah. Let's quickly
and when you say that to people, they come back and say, well, the federal government is never going to default on its obligations because that would cause havoc in the entire world. And you know what? And I tend to agree with that, that the federal government will never default on its obligations. Yeah. But what they will do, Andrew, with impunity is they'll print money. Right. And they'll print money to the point where, we're going to pay Social Security benefits and we'll print the money to pay the Social Security benefits. But a loaf of bread is going to cost $38 when we're done doing it.
Yep, that's exactly right. Let's talk about, by the way, a restaurant down the block from me just opened up. You know what the price of a key lime pie slice is? It's a steakhouse. It's a fine steakhouse. So let's just go there first. $22.
For a slice of pie?
That's correct. Not a pie, a slice of pie. Maybe a big slice of pie, but not a pie.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Harris plan and the cuts that she's imposing. Okay, let's move on now. The only thing she did was, we have no tax on tips also. But Harris is talking about increasing capital. there's no Harris.
First of all, that was so absurd because her people criticized the Trump plan, brutally as being, an idea to buy votes, which of course it is. But then she comes along and does the same
thing. It was a great idea. It was a great thing. I mean, what you're going to do, we'll do it. Here's the thing. Increasing capital gains tax. Now, let me tell you a really twisted discussion about this. And we're going to do this very quickly. I do believe that we actually have to raise taxes because if we are to be a company that is respected and a country that has our balance sheets in good shape and we want to continue with Social Security benefits and the payments and cut down on the debt payments, the money's going to come from somewhere. This misguided idea that you cut taxes down to zero or whatever, you reduce taxes, and then all of a sudden you create all this excess revenue to come in. It doesn't work.
Well, it does work to a certain extent within certain boundaries. But here's the reality. We are never, ever going to get our arms around the federal debt problem unless we address the question of spending. All right. There has to be massive cuts in federal spending, because the reality is if they continue with the spending pattern they're on, and I'm talking about Democrats and Republicans both, nobody is immune to this spending addiction. Right. Nobody is. And until we get our arms around that, there's no tax model that anybody can think of that you and I could name that will provide enough revenue to satisfy those needs.
That's correct.
It just isn't going to be enough, no matter what we do.
Right. And that's not only spending, but it's on top of the spending, the debt that we've already amassed. Because now we're paying almost $1 trillion a year in debt service. If we were to start from scratch, just like blow it all away, I could, one year you had this, so the next year maybe you reduce down the tax, but reducing down tax on eliminating tax on tips or eliminating tax on overtime is spending, just in a different wrapper.
It's not spending in the traditional sense, and this is how they've distorted the discussion. All right, to call that spending is to take the position that the federal government owns every dollar you generate, right? Every dollar in income you generate belongs to the federal government, not a percentage of the dollar, but every dollar you own. And so if we're going to give back some money, let you keep some money, then that is an expenditure on our part out of our grace to allow you to keep some money. That's a distorted view of the economic reality here. The economic reality is that the government has no money, all right? The money comes from either taxation or it comes from borrowing borrowing or it comes from printing. There's only three ways a government can raise revenue. And each one of those actions, whether it's taxation or borrowing or printing, every single one of the consequences of that behavior falls back to the taxpayer who has to pay the bill. So it is not accurate, and it's not fair to say that tax cuts are spending. They are not. The only spending that occurs is what shows up on the federal budget, the line item budget, and that's where the cuts have to occur. The cuts must come from the government outlays, and about 80%, maybe 75% of all federal spending is transfer payments, Andrew, taking money from the people giving it to the people who haven't earned it. That has to change.
Yeah. But increasing capital gains tax, do you think that's a smart thing to do or not?
No, I think it's a bad idea. The more you, and the historical economic records bear this out, the more you increase capital gains rates, the less revenue you generate through capital gains taxation. And the reason for that is because the capital gains tax is, in every sense of the word, a voluntary tax. In that, if I'm sitting on an appreciated asset and that capital gains rate is 28%, I'm not going to sell the asset until the sea changes occur, the political sea changes occur, which I know are going to happen at some point, right, where the tax rate drops back to maybe 25 or 23 or 20% or whatever it may be, then I'll sell the asset. So this is an effect that's called lock-in, all right? And it's very real, and it's demonstrable over the years. The higher the capital gains rate, the less revenue you get from capital gains taxes. The fact of the matter is the smart thing would be to reduce capital gains taxes even further.
Really? Okay, that's interesting. I wouldn't be upset about it personally. Okay, I will also mention that. Again, I'm just wondering if we don't have the income in, what happens there? Let's just skip past the whole tax on unrealized gains. It's not happening. Let's just get that straight. Be done with it. No one can. That's too complicated.
I'm not so sure about that. I believe. That if the Democrats had total control of the federal government, I believe that an unrealized capital gains tax would be passed into law. The question is whether it would survive a constitutional challenge. I don't think there's any doubt they would pass it if they could. The question is whether it would stand up to legal scrutiny.
That's interesting. That would be a mess, don't you think?
Oh, it'd be an absolute mess. It'd be a total mess. No question about it. It would be virtually unenforceable. Well, it wouldn't be unenforceable, but it would be extremely, extremely difficult to administer it. Think of it this way. There'd have to be an audit every single year of every single person that was subject to that tax. Well, you say, well, okay, fine. If it's only billionaires, there aren't that many. That's true. But this is the other thing that bothers me about the proposal, is there has never been a tax in history, in the history of the United States anyway, maybe there's one in the world somewhere, but in the history of the United States, there's never been a tax that was originally imposed on high-income people that did not drift down to the middle class at some point, sooner or later. I am completely convinced that a tax on unrealized capital gains would filter down to the middle class sooner or later.
I got you. Let's take a quick break. I want to talk about some of the year-end tax tips that we have in mind here. So just stick around for a second then, all right?
Sure.
And let's talk about Interactive Brokers again, because Interactive Brokers has key competitive advantages for sophisticated investors just like you. IBKR's margin loan rates are from just 5.33% to 6.33%, and it's rated among the lowest margin fees by stockbrokers.com. In fact, I want you to compare IBKR's low margin borrowing cost to other brokers, and these guys that are out there charge hundreds of basis points more. You just look them up, find them, Fidelity, Vanguard, all the other ones out there rated. You know, of course, we know that the rates are subject to change, but if you look at a lower borrowing cost, well, it makes a lot more sense. Margin is only for experienced investors with high risk tolerance, because you may in fact lose more than your initial investment. The best informed investors, though, choose Interactive Brokers. Go to IBKR.com/compare. Find out more about all the issues related to margin, the rates, and how you can qualify. We're back again with Dan Pila, the expert in in all things tax and particularly in IRS. You know, by the way, let me ask you before we get into this section about some year-end tax tips. What exactly should someone do if they get that dreaded letter in the mail?
Well, of course, it depends what dreaded letter we're talking about. But if we're talking about a collection notice, which is the notices that the IRS has really turned the crank on now, starting in January of this year, you need to understand your rights to what are called a collection due process hearing. The IRS cannot lay a glove on your asset. They can't touch, they can't seize a postage stamp, Andrew, from you before they mail a final notice of intent to levy and notice of your right to a hearing. That's the letter that gives you an opportunity for what's called a collection due process appeal. This probably is the most important right that taxpayers have, at least in my opinion. It's the most important right that taxpayers have, because this is the, when you file that request for collection due process hearing, that stops enforced collection in its tracks. As I said, the IRS can't lay a glove on anything that you own while that appeal is pending. So the case goes out of the collection function, goes into the appeals process, and the written job description of the appeals office is to negotiate some kind of settlement with the taxpayer. And in fact, when we're talking about collection due process, the statutory guidelines are for these appeals officers to consider collection alternatives. Mm. In other words, the IRS says, I owe $50,000, but I can't pay it. Well, maybe you're entitled to an installment agreement. Maybe you're entitled to penalty relief. Maybe there's an innocent spouse involved. Maybe you're going to do an offer and compromise. There's all kinds of different collection alternatives that the IRS must and will consider when you lay those on the table. The other distinct advantage of a collection due process appeal is if you can't come to terms with that appeals office, if you can't work that out in some amicable way, you as the taxpayer have the right to pursue that further into the United States tax court. You got judicial appeal rights. And because you have that leverage, the appeals office almost always comes up with some reasonable decision and some reasonable resolution to your collection case. So you got to understand collection due process appeal rights.
So let me just summarize that for you for a sec. Can I summarize that for our audience so they understand that?
Sure.
My question was, what happens if you get that dreaded letter? What happens if you get that audit letter or that collection letter? And you gave us all that thing. Let me just summarize this very quickly. Call Dan. How's that, Dan? Does that work a little better for you? Call Dan.
Well, you can do that. You can also look at my book, How to Get Tax Amnesty for the Collection Letters and How to Win Your Tax Audit for the Audit Letters. And I walk you through all of this.
Yeah, good stuff. Anyway, so let's talk about some 2024 year-end tax tips. And I don't know, we can go through a lot of different things that people need to start thinking about, because here we are in October already. And I mean, what do we got? We got things like, I don't know, accelerate deductions. How do people do some of those things?
Well, you want to accelerate deductions to the extent that you can pay expenses in 2024. This is particularly true of businesses now. So here we're coming up to the end of the year. We're in the third or fourth quarter of 2024, and a business looks at their situation and they know that they're going to have to incur certain operating expenses, certain expenses in 2025. If you push those expenses into 2024, you get a deduction for the expense in the year that it's paid. Now, this is true if you're a cash basis taxpayer, which most people are. That is to say, you claim your deductions when the expense is paid, and you report your income when the income is earned, regardless of when it's received. So by doing that, but this is particularly helpful, Andrew, if you've had higher income in 2024 than you anticipate having in 2025. So this takes a little planning. It takes a little reading, right? Sit down with your accountant and figure this out. If you've had some windfalls in 2024 that you don't think are going to repeat themselves in 2025, you know, you're back down to your normal level. Well, then accelerate those deductions into 2024 and offset some of that income. Individual taxpayers can do that by paying their state income taxes. Now, of course, in Florida, you don't have that problem, but most of us around the country are paying state income taxes. Now, of course, that problem is exacerbated by the fact that state and local income taxes are capped at $10,000. So you want to be careful about that as well. You don't want to get yourself above that cap if you don't have to.
Making charitable donations at the end of the year. Obviously, you know, it's a good thing to help out our fellow men and women out there that are in need, and whether it's, or whatever the organization could be, something related to pets for that matter.
But
Yeah, exactly.
The
right.
point is you got to make these donations by the end of the year or they don't count for the end of the year.
Yeah, they don't count for this year. And again, for those individuals that might have had a little bit higher income in 2024, here's a way for an individual to do it. If you don't have a business to fund, you can make charitable contributions. And there's a lot of organizations in Florida that could use a little help right now, as exactly. we all know. And so, you know, most certainly consider doing that. The thing you got to keep in mind about charitable contributions is if you give more than $250 to any one charitable organization, you need to get a contemporaneous receipt back from the organization that verifies that you gave the gift and also verifies that you received nothing of economic substance in return for your payment. Right, that it was in fact a gift and not a purchase of some kind of product or service of some kind. So that's got to be stated in the receipt. So keep that in mind that when you give money, you got to get that receipt back that confirms that no benefits were received.
So when you say that, if I give money to the Church of Fishing for a whole week in Mexico and spend my time down there fishing, it may not actually be a deductible item because I got some economic benefit from it.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
The Church of Fishing. Correct.
Let's say this. Let's say you give $5,000 to an organization, right? And they're going to give you back the fishing trip in exchange for your gift, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's say the value of the fishing trip is $2,000. If you went out and bought it yourself, it's a $2,000 trip. Well, you're going to give the $5,000 because you want to help the church. And plus you want to go with all your buddies, right? Mm-hmm. So you give the $5,000, you get the $2,000 trip. Your tax deduction is the difference between the gift and the fair market value of what you got back. So in that case, the tax deduction is $3,000, not five.
And the church has to be a 501c3.
Exactly. Yes.
It has to be a legitimate.
Churches. Well, let's be careful about this. Churches don't necessarily have to be a 501c3 organization. They are automatically exempt. Yeah. Charitable organizations, religious organizations, other than churches, educational organizations, organizations that are set up to help children and animals and so on. They have to be 501c3.
Huh. Let's give me a little bit of an interesting idea here about opening up a fishing camp in Mexico or Guatemala or Panama.
Sure.
You have all these guys will come down and get these big tax deductions and we'll get the cost of the fishing to be less, but we'll talk about that offline. Now, what about the other side of the other coin where maybe I'm not making as much, maybe I am making, let's say it this way, I'm making a lot of money this year, but next year I don't think I'm making that much money. Can I defer income somehow?
Well, yeah, you can to a certain extent. It depends on how you're earning the money, right? If you're a wage earner and you expect your wages to drop, you're not going to be able to. Probably unlikely that you can defer income from 2024 into 2025 unless your employer agrees to do that, right? And so if that's the case, then that would help you. But as a self-employed individual running a small business, they've got a lot more control over their billing practices and collection practices. So you might sit down with a client in early December or mid-December and say, okay, listen, we're gonna book this transaction. We're going to book this sale. We're going to sign the contract, let's say, but we're not gonna trade dollars until January or February of next year. So that would give you the opportunity to defer. So if you've got already high income in 2024, and again, you're expecting that little bit of downturn in 2025, you know, then that is where the advantage would lie in deferring the income forward.
The other thing that I think that goes without saying, and I'll throw this one out there and I'll talk about this, is the whole idea of, you know, utilizing your retirement plan to its greatest ability. The fact is that a lot of people are like, well, my company has a 401k, but they don't really give a matching contribution, so I am not going to play. I'm like, what are you talking about? The government's giving you a 20-something percent contribution every time that you put money in as in the form of a deduction off your income. I don't understand. So the company's not giving you the 3%? Okay, it would be nice. It'd be nice. But make sure that you fund fully IRAs, 401ks, or 403bs, or SEPs. Set some of these up before the end of the year. If you are an individual that doesn't have a pension plan now, whether it's a simple or a SEP, a lot of these things you have to set up before the end of the year. You could fund it maybe as of the last day of your filing date for some of these things. But make sure that you set these up and you're done and ready to fund these. So that's something.
I agree. Yep.
So the other thing is, I think we have to also bring this and pull this full circle, weighing and looking at year-end investment moves. Because, for example, if Harris becomes the president and people freak out, for example, that capital gains rates are going to go up, we could see a significant disruption in markets due to that. Now, of course, a lot of things have to happen. You know, it has to be Democrat, matching Congress and legislative branch. It has to be a matching, and then everybody has to agree with it too, right? That's another whole problem. But think about, for the end of the year, looking at how many carry forward losses or look at where your potential positioning is and your income, because capital gains right now, it's 0, 15, or 20, depending on what your income level is, right?
Well, and there's another consideration too, Andrew, and that's got really nothing to do with who's president, whether it's Democrat or Republican. And that is this: when you've got capital losses, those losses are subject to a $3,000 cap. So if you lose 20 grand in the market, you can't write off 20 grand. You can only write off $3,000 a year as a capital loss, unless you have other capital gains that can offset those losses, right? So what you want to do, and I think this is important, as I said, regardless of who's president, is sit down with your investment advisor at the end of the year and say, okay, we've got these gains, we've got these losses. All right, do we want to take some profit on the gains to offset some of the losses? Because if you've got, let's say you got $10,000 worth of capital gains, well, now you can take $10,000 worth of capital losses to offset those gains. And if you have no gains, then as I said, you're limited to $3,000 a year. So you want to try to balance that out if you can.
Yeah, good stuff. Dan Piller, we're going to put all the information on how to get in touch with you, of course, on the show notes for episode number 891 of The Disciplined Investor over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, people can get in touch with you, get your great newsletter. I'm holding it in my hand right now with your fancy picture on top right there, but you can go over. I'm going to give this out for you. Okay. If you want to get, first of all, get a question, you can send an email to support@taxhelponline.com. Is that correct?
That's correct. Support@taxhelponline.com.
Yeah. You want to say, get a newsletter. You get a newsletter in the subject line. There's also the Tax Defense Conference coming up. There's all sorts of things coming up. So make sure to get in touch with Dan. If you have any questions on what's going on in your situation, especially if you get the letter, call Dan. So, Dan, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Andrew. It's good to talk to you. God bless you, man. Thanks. I'm glad you're safe down there.
Thanks. And that's going to wrap up this episode of The Disciplined Investor. We have a great analyst, newsletter writer. We have just a wonderful, wonderful gentleman, Ed Easterling. He's coming on next week. He's from Crestmont Holdings, and you could check him out and find out more about what is going on in his world by going to crestmontresearch.com. But in the meantime, I'm getting ready to ask him a lot of questions on what is going to happen moving forward. And I think there's a lot of really good insights he's going to provide. Thank you so much for joining me each and every week. Of course, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out what's available there. In fact, why not think about becoming a client? You know, something that we could probably do a great job for you with your IRA, with your individual account, with your trusts, getting you on the road to and path towards financial security and independence in the future. That's what we do here at Horowitz & Company. Thanks for joining me this week. Thank you for joining me every week. Thanks for spreading the word about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.
Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.